We have the one and only reveal. Ah, damn it, I messed up. Anyway, Snape pulls back the invisibility cloak, revealing he was there the entire time. That's
Dang
it.
it.
I went off the answer. Okay,
Okay.
there we go.
Thanks, Paul.
I have poorer writing but higher production value.
That's one way of looking at it.
Hello and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. We are back this time around to continue our ongoing reread of Harry Potter. In this podcast, we will finish The Prisoner of Azkaban, covering the final seven chapters in the third book. My name is Zach, also known as Alias on the podcast of Ice and Fire forums, and joining me we have...
Hi everyone, it's Mary on Nymeria on the forums.
Hey guys, this is Small Paul, Sir General on the forums.
Hi, this is Abby or Daisy Mormont.
This is Adam, Jon Snow.
This is Michal, Ink Azrain.
And I am Paul, also known as Pod's Plague.
Excellent. Thank you all so much for joining me for this. So just as a reminder, this podcast is full spoilers for everything in the Harry Potter universe, including The Cursed Child and the Fantastic Beasts films. So before we get started, I believe we have a newcomer to the Harry Potter reread in Abby. So, Abby, would you be so kind as to regale us with the story of how you got into Harry Potter?
Sure. So, first of all, I was actually not born when Harry Potter came out. Mm. So
we're at that point.
So, yeah, so I didn't get this. I grew up with Harry Potter right when it came out. But I started reading the books when I was six because I had an older brother who really liked Harry Potter. And I was like, oh, my gosh, everything my brother likes, I have to like. It took me a really long time to read the first book. So that was my experience. Also, when I was a kid, we used to play Harry Potter instead of like House or something. So I guess I hadn't even like seen the books or read the movies when we did that. So I was probably everything was wrong, but I was really into it. So yeah, that's awesome. My experience.
Very cool. All right. So let us begin with the chapters where in this book, shit really hits the fan. So
the best
who better
part.
To lead? Yeah. So who better to lead the way into that madness than Mr. Big Paul himself?
Alrighty
take
then.
Us away with chapter 16. Mm-hmm.
So June is on the way and the students of Hogwarts just can't stop that summer feeling. Just like Justin Timberlake. They got that sunshine on the docket, got them gobstones at their feet. You feel that hot sweat on the body when it drops. Ooh, you can't take your eyes up off it, moving so phenomenally. Squid on the lake, the waves, they rocket, so don't stop. And out on the lawn, where everything goes. Nowhere to hide when exam's getting close. How teens move, well, you already know. So just imagine, just imagine, just imagine. Nothing left for them to do besides cram, cram, cram. Thank you, thank you. And speaking of cramming, Fred and George appear to be actually taking their owls rather seriously. While Percy is even more high-strung than usual as he attempts to handle the mounting pressure of his upcoming newt while edging ever nearer the precipice of losing it entirely. Similarly, Hermione is an anxious wreck as she frantically prepares to take on a multitude of simultaneous examinations. If only she could find some extra hours in the day so that she could study to her heart's content at a much more leisurely pace. But alas. After looking at her schedule, Harry and Ron are curious and concerned about how she's planning to squeeze more than one exam into a single time slot. She brushes off their concerns and assures her that she can handle it. The crew gets a message from Hagrid that Buckbeak's appeal is coming up soon. It's happening on site at Hogwarts, and the Ministry is bringing an executioner along, all in the name of expediency. Soon, their exams are underway. Transfigurations test tasks takers to turn teapots to tortoises. Results vary, but most are left limp and despondent, unhappy with their performance. Next up is Flitwick's Charms Challenge, wherein children enchantingly cast cheering charms on each other. Harry accidentally cracks up Ron into hysterical fits of laughter, which require him to take some time, some quiet time alone to recover from. The following day, Hagrid's animal handling test requires the students to go for one whole hour while keeping their hands off their flabberworms so that they can go about their lives without getting overly agitated. That afternoon, Harry totally blows his potions exam. Suffering from performance anxiety under Snape's ever-watchful gaze, Harry can only produce a weak, watery offering on what was meant to be a much thicker, confusing concoction. Astronomy requires the students to get high in the tallest tower and stare at the stars. As a result, Harry spends much of his history exam with the munchies craving chocolate sundaes while feeling paranoid and writing about old-timey witch hunts. And the fun continues as the students are back at it the next day, baking in the hot box of the greenhouse for herbology credit. Defense against the dark arts has for defense against the dark arts, Lupin has set up an obstacle course where the students have to wade grundle deep with a Grindelow, avoid holes with any holes with bloody red caps, maneuver through a marshy swamp while ignoring misdirection from a hinky punk, and then bunk in a trunk to tangle with a Bogart. Harry does everything perfect. Ron gets hinky punked in the quagmire, a giggity, and Hermione gets trunked on by Bogart McGonagall, telling her that she has failed all of her exams. The final test is that of Professor Trelawney. She's examining the students individually and swearing them to silence about what takes place in the privacy of her exam room, going so far as to threaten Neville with a horrible accident should he ever tell anyone. Basically, she's making the students stare at her odd orbs and tell her what they see, or more accurately, what she wants to hear. Similar to herbology, the room is hot, pungent, and smoky. Harry pretends to see a hippogriff. Trelawney wants to know about its head. Harry says it's fine. Trelawney suggests that perhaps it's writhing around in agony with a shadowy figure behind it. Harry feels sick and says no. Trelawney asks if there's blood and or tears. Harry wants to leave and says that the hippogriff flew away. Trelawney sighs in disappointment. As Harry's getting up to go, a harsh voice says, "It will happen tonight." Wheeling around, Harry sees Trelawney has gone rigid in her chair, staring blankly, mouth agape. Her eyes roll back and Harry thinks of running for help. The strange voice goes all ironborn and says the Dark Lord may never die, but will rise again, harder and stronger. Before midnight tonight, his servant will break free and rejoin him. Trelawney's head falls to her chest. She makes a strange grunting snort, and then snaps her head back up, dreamily apologizes for having dozed off for a moment. Harry stares dumbfounded, and tells her what she just said, but she does not believe him. As he's leaving, Harry wonders if this was Trelawney's first real prediction, or another one of her theatrical shenanigans. Before he can tell the others about the possession-slash-prophecy-slash-performance art, another note from Hagrid informs them that the appeal has been lost. They all want to go see Hagrid, but need to get the invisibility cloak back first. Hermione volunteers to fetch it, but needs to know how to handle the hump statue. Harry tells her to just tap that and say the word. She returns shortly with the cloak, and Ron is quite impressed with her brazenness, and Hermione is duly flattered by his admiration. They all hide under the cloak and sneak off to Hagrid's. He is distraught and accidentally breaks a milk jug while trying to make some tea. While Hermione is rummaging around looking for more big jugs, instead of just fixing the one that broke, she's startled to find Scabbers hiding there. Ron manages to stuff the rat in his pocket as they are all being bundled out the back door because the ministry folks are now approaching the cabin. They try to stay hidden and sneak away, but Scabbers is freaking out and trying to break free. While the three of them are out of sight, they hear the men indistinctly talking, and then they hear the thud of an axe and fear that Buckbeak has surely shuffled off this mortal coil. And that's all.
Well done.
Thank you, Big Paul, for the singing and the alliteration and everything.
My pleasure.
All right. So, obviously, this chapter kind of sets up everything that we're about to experience later, but is there, before we get into that kind of stuff, any thoughts on the kind of the first half of the chapter, the exams, all that stuff? I do love, as you said, Paul, that iconic Hermione moment in the Defense Against the Dark Arts exam with the Bogart McGonagall failed everything. Just
that's as bad Hermione. As it can get.
Of course.
Oh, during the charms exam, they have Harry perform the charm on Ron, and then Ron has his exam delayed. And I think that's so stupid to have the students test on each other, because what if the charm went wrong and then Ron just wasn't even able to ever take his exam? I just think that's not very good planning.
Lots of negligent teachers at Hogwarts.
Oh, yeah. Big time. What? Chalk it up on the list of all the terrible things that they do at this school.
Well, Harry goes on about how he, like, blows his potions exam and he fails at these various things. But then at the end, he's like, oh, yeah, he passed and did well in all his exams. So it's weird that they can, like, and when they were doing Transfiguration, they, like, none of them can turn it into a proper tortoise, but then they all pass and do fine.
Well, maybe it's like when I was in high school, I think it was all our finals were worth 20%. So I would just calculate what I needed to get on my final to keep like an A or a B. And sometimes it would be you need to get a 60 on the final, you know. And so maybe it's something like that.
The minimum effort.
Yeah, that's what I did in high school.
You're like a monk.
I mean.
Yeah. I also think that'll work. It's funny what you said, Paul, about Hermione not, like, having enough time to take all these extra classes, but not enough time to study for them.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that's such a Hermione thing. Like, of course you would never use the time turner to have more hours to study in. It's just for the classes. Absolutely. Only. And I'm just like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's why she got the time turner.
I do think that's smart, though, right? Because if she did start to use it too much, that would probably be
really bad. Problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you suppose the ministry can actually monitor those, like, see when people are using them? You would think they would, but then they don't know that she's using it at the end of the book when she goes back in time to fix everything. So it's kind of maybe a plot hole, but maybe they just don't know or don't care.
Plot holes with the time turner? What?
Yeah.
No. I do also love, as you mentioned, the no blood, no weeping Hagrid Trelawney moment. She's like kind of disappointed. Just a little weird from Trelawney, but that's who she is.
An odd duck.
She's here for the drama.
Do you guys think that Trelawney is pretending not to know that she made a prophecy, or does she actually not know that she made a prophecy?
Oh, she doesn't know.
She goes into like a fugue state.
Yeah, I would say fugue state, that she just loses it.
But... Yeah, when she's conscious, I feel like she gives completely false prophecies, and then once she's not aware she's giving a prophecy, that's when the truth comes out. Oh, yeah, that's the only reason Dumbledore keeps her around.
Yeah, I think Dumbledore does just for the shits and giggles. That is just funny.
Yeah, typical Dumbledore trolling. Even says at the end of the book when Harry tells him the prophecy, he's like, I should give her a pay raise for doing that. Dumbledore. We'll get to him. So I had a question. Why do you guys think Scabbers is trying to escape at this point? Like, why wouldn't he just stick with Ron and try to go up to the castle and just go back to his normal life? Why is he trying to get out at this juncture?
Well, same reason is he was trying to escape already before. It's just because, I mean, same reason he actually escaped, because he knows Sirius is coming for him.
And Crookshanks is on the hunt. He is right there looking and trying to get him.
Crookshanks probably smells him. Smells Sirius, too. Just trying to get out of there.
Yeah, I think like Crookshanks has been like deputized officially for Sirius, and anything that Peter, that, you know, because who's going to be better at finding a rat than a cat, right? So
true enough.
And I wonder if Scabbers has been in Hagrid's hut the whole time, or if he just was there at this particular time and he had been roaming around other places.
Honestly,
not that it matters one way or the other, but.
Well, that's the strange thing, right? Like, why would he stay on the grounds and hide still here and not try to, like, go somewhere else?
I'm always surprised that, like, Rowling doesn't mention that, like, there are hundreds of cats just walking around Hogwarts because most of the students wanted a cat as a familiar.
So not to engage in a time travel discussion, but do you guys think that at this point in the narrative, the axe is swishing down on Buckbeak's neck, or is already it not swishing on anything? Like, how does that work?
That's not something that we can ever know.
It works. Fair enough. Best if you don't ask that question.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I'd say it's just personal preference if you want to imagine that Buckbeak died and then was saved in a different timeline, or if it's all one timeline and it just they already traveled back from the future and that kind of weirdness.
Does this follow Endgame rules?
Right. Yeah. It's like that.
Well, they do hear one last pair of feet hurrying across the floor and a door slamming, which is Harry and Hermione right when they land after the time turner and they like hide in the closet. So I have to suspect that it all works out cyclically.
I think it's just one timeline
based on the later chapter.
Yeah, because I mean, same thing with the Patronus. Like, Harry actually sees the Patronus that he himself will make afterwards. So
and the only reason he's able to do it is because he already believes he can. So it's kind of circular weirdness, but we'll do it.
But I think it does make kind of sense. It's just she makes it very clear that they can't be seen, and then it kind of works, you know. And they couldn't go back like three times or whatever, or cross path. But they just come back once, do what they need to do, and then it's done.
I really kind of like the idea of using time travel as preventative rather than like fixing things, you know, like their main goal is like, they know this is going to happen to Sirius, but in their timeline, it has not happened to Sirius. So if they can prevent that, that makes a lot more sense to me than like going back and saving him retroactively or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I'm just confused now.
I hate time travel. I've actually started, like, I hate it. I absolutely hate time travel.
Yeah. It's nuts.
We can go back in time and fix that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'll do that. Let me grab my time turner. Okay. All right, so any other thoughts on chapter 16?
Buckbeak's execution is a day after Draco's birthday, so a technically belated birthday present originally.
Yeah. Fucking birthday.
It's meant to be. It's too bad for Draco. All right, chapter 17, Cat, Rat, and Dog. And I believe it's Marie taking us through this one.
Yep. All right, just a sec. Yes. Okay. So, sorry, guys. It's not in French.
Darn.
Yeah. but Abby might have understood, so it would have been fun, but nope. So, Ron, Harry, and Hermione are leaving Hagrid's, and they are devastated when Burke is killed. Scabbers is going crazy in Ron's pocket, and he flies to flee. The huge dog and Crookshanks crash the party, and the dog grabs and drags Ron through an opening under the Whomping Willow. Harry and Hermione want to follow, but the willow won't let them until Crookshanks finds the right button to stop the tree. Easy. They go in, they follow through the secret tunnel, and end up in the Shrieking Shack. I did have to like look that up to see how it was in English. They find Ron with his broken leg and ta-da, Sirius Black. He looks like a proper bad guy. Like, he talks about murdering people and finally doing what he was in prison for. He disarms Harry and Hermione, but Harry attacks him Muggle style and manages to get his wand back. He wants to kill him, hesitates, can't push himself to do it, and then Lupin arrives. And he disarms everyone, because like Expelliarmus is the one charm they all know. So then Lupin and Sirius have kind of a coded conversation about who actually was James and Lily's secret keeper. They hug, and Hermione loses it and reveals, despite Lupin's attempts to explain, that he's a werewolf. While Lupin tries to explain, Sirius is sitting on the bed like a crazy person, and Lupin reveals that he saw their names on the Marauders map and saw another name with them, Peter Pettigrew, who's supposed to be dead. And then he saw the whole thing through the map, and Sirius taking two of them to the shrieking shack. Lupin asks to see Scabbers, and Ron asks what a rat has to do with the whole thing. To everyone's surprise, Sirius and Lupin reveals that it's not a rat. It's Peter Pettigrew. And that's the chapter.
So many shocking reveals.
Ta-da.
And more to come.
Yeah.
What is the Shrieking Shack in French?
La Cabane Hurlante, which actually makes, like, it's literally the translation.
Very nice.
So I love how Sirius cannot read the room at all.
Yeah. He definitely needs to work on his communication skills, because if he just like talked clearly and explained himself, he has to be also creepy and like angry and stuff.
That's one of my
biggest. Yeah, I killed them.
Yeah. Oh,
no, you didn't. Just isn't that the time to like just say, no, I didn't kill your parents?
It's one of my biggest pet peeves in authors when they try to drag out a secret for. I understand like it progresses the plot, because if Sirius was just kind of like, he thinks he killed them, but if he was like, I wasn't the secret keeper immediately, then they could just sit and talk and have a nice chat, and then Snape wouldn't have to come in and, you know, do his thing. So I don't know, but it just annoys me when they drag out these secrets and create unnecessary drama. I hate unnecessary drama.
I think it's very much intended to be frustrating, right? Because you want them to just understand what's going on. Like, reading these, especially knowing what happens, is incredibly frustrating. But in a way that serves the tension.
I agree that I hate that, but I think that here it makes sense, since Sirius has spent 12 years in prison, basically in solitary confinement with soul-sucking demons, and half the time he spent as an animal, like, I don't know.
Yeah,
how he ever managed to buy that broom, I don't understand.
His people skills has definitely waned.
It's easy. Like, you send a cat. Don't you guys do that?
Yeah, of course. That's what I would do.
But yeah, it is pretty clear that, like, Sirius, yes, he's in his right mind, so to speak, but he's not necessarily, like, interacting with human people normal yet, which makes sense. I think, like, you know, part of it, I remember my mind being just so blown when I read this the first time, and, like, because it's like, what are you talking about? The rat, like, there's no connection there at all. And then the fact that, like, it all ties together, and I remember going back and just being like, oh yeah, this is when we thought Sirius was bad. And it's like, on either side of that reveal, you're, like, shocked at the reality of it. And the way, you know, Sirius is communicating is not the best.
Yeah, until the very last moment, it feels 100% like Sirius is going to kill Harry. Mm-hmm. Like, it's layered so well to give you that feeling. Even knowing what's going to happen, it still feels that way, reading it.
Yeah.
But even being so rough around the edges and kind of crazy like that, Harry's still real psyched at the prospect of moving in with him at the end when he finds out he's his godfather. It doesn't take much to sway Harry's allegiance.
Yeah,
the Dursleys are.
The other thing I was wondering is about Lupin. It was watching the Marauder's Rat map and sees him moving across. Does the Marauder's Rat map not see future and past selves? Because then he would see two Harrys and two Hermiones all running around, and then be even more confusing.
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
Oh no, I never thought about that.
Because apparently they're invisible to their
The only way it works is if he's looking at the map at the right moment and sees them disappear down that tunnel and bolts while they're still, like, way off in the forest, off to the side, and just not looking there.
But they're, like,
if he was staring at the map, if he's staring at the map all night, like, he's definitely going to run in, like, to two sets of them, so I don't know. Then he'd get real confused and just think it's broken.
Tricky. Nice little key line about Harry here. It says, he had forgotten about magic. He had forgotten that he was short and skinny and 13, whereas Black was a tall, full-grown man. All Harry knew was that he wanted to hurt Black as badly as he could, and that he didn't care how much he got hurt in return. So, two aspects of Harry that are kind of revealed there. One, of course, his bravery, his willingness to put himself at risk no matter the cost to himself, and also his sort of anger, his overwhelming, well justified, you would think, you know, rage. It still is rage he is feeling at this moment.
Also have a lot of sympathy for Ron with his shattered leg that got twisted all the way off breaking it in the one window there. That's gotta be quite a lot of pain.
Yeah, I would think.
I think it's so sad after Hermione reveals that Lupin is a werewolf, and then, like, Ron freaks out when, like, Lupin starts. It's so sad. I don't think he's revealed his whole, like, Dumbledore was the only one that would accept me as a student, blah, 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 yet, but it just makes us so sad.
So when Lupin's going toward Ron, he says, "Get away from me, werewolf." And you have to think, and Lupin just freezes. So you have to think, how many times has Lupin heard that? And how many times has he had to internalize what that feels like for someone to say, "Get away from me, werewolf." It's really strong.
Are there no werewolf hunters in this world?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I can't think of any.
It's also like Hogwarts was supposed to be the place, both as a kid and as an adult, that he could be free of that. Yeah. And the fact that it follows him, like, you really feel a certain amount of, like, being hunted. Like, I'll tell you who the werewolf hunter is. It's all of Wizarding society. Mm-hmm. And they're all going, you know, like, you see how quickly Ron turns, right? Like, he likes Lupin, you know? And the only reason Hermione hasn't told anybody is because she's muggle-born and she's more open-minded about this kind of thing. And, like, it's one of the saddest...
Well,
Yeah.
I mean, they say now that there's, like, sort of a cure. He just takes the potion and he's chill every month. So, like, people should be like, all right, cool, werewolf is not so bad. But there wasn't a cure when he was younger, which is what they explain later. But again, like, if society, especially wizarding society, is, like, really ostracizes the werewolves, why don't they kill them?
Well, because maybe for a lot of people, like, maybe some more powerful people in wizarding society actually have loved ones who are werewolves, and they don't care about everyone else who's a werewolf, but
like
this
maybe
one
there was
specific
a moderate
person.
Reform or something at some point. Or...
Yeah, I'm assuming it would be like a moderate reform.
I think it's more the werewolves kind of don't tend to interact with wizarding society. I think in the Deathly Hallows or something, don't they talk about like they all kind of like live on their own a bit, and then they
prey on muggles.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they just kind of tend to keep out of wizarding society more.
Because it seems like there's kind of a movement for, like, self-acceptance. If, like, you know, because I don't think the invention of the Wolfsbane potion made much difference at all in the way wizarding society thinks of werewolves right. And other, like, part human people.
The prejudice is still there.
Yeah, and we don't know how widespread the Wolfsbane potion is. Apparently it's obviously very hard to make. But I think that, like, the fact, like, the prejudice is way stronger than any argument against it. And that becomes, I actually really like how that becomes a huge motivating factor for Lupin and for, you know, and kind of, like, against Umbridge and her view on society. And it becomes something that Voldemort takes advantage of later because, like, the idea that wizarding society can, like, create the seeds of its own destruction, even though they're the good guys, is, I think, really, really powerful and well done.
And to address the question of why they don't just kill them, I think it's pretty clear that there, you know, there's layers of prejudice, right? It's not like a binary thing where it's like you're accepted or we just murder you. And that's something that's clearly trying to kind of reflect, you know, obviously different kinds of prejudice that have occurred at various points in history. And, like, you're not just going to, like, kill off a human just because you hate them, but you are going to, in so many ways, limit who they can be and limit their potential and all these
right.
ways.
I think it also, I guess I'm just more thinking,
like, traditional werewolves, and then we get, like, Fenrir, Greyback, and all them later that are, like, how come they're still alive? I don't know.
I think it's more because wizarding society is so prejudiced against muggles, and so if the werewolves are just preying on the muggles, first of all, I don't think that the muggles
nice.
Can I think that if a muggle gets bit by a werewolf, I doubt that they can turn into a werewolf because they're not, like, a magical being, you know? So they probably just die, and so the wizards are probably like, meh, it's not our problem.
It's an interesting layer. Adds some complexity to it. Some more ambiguity.
Well, I mean, I do think it is a pattern of the wizarding world. Like, they would way prefer to shove problems under the bed.
Yeah.
Like, it defines what they do with Voldemort. They don't want to know, you know? So they don't want to know if someone's a werewolf. They just want them to go away and stop, you know? Like, the fact that, you know, the way Lupin talks about his parents, just assuming that he would never be able to go to school, is, I think, you know, partly indicative of that also.
Inaction is the norm
mm-hmm.
in so many ways. So, on a lighter note, you know, some action. When that part where it says that Hermione kicks Sirius, I just picture her, like, roundhouse kicking him for some reason. That's just what I picture. In my head.
Jean-Claude Van Damme style, just like,
yeah.
Just Patrick like she flies Swayze out in Roadhouse.
Oh my god, this is my one move, guys.
Yeah. I love it. Also, Cruikshank's leaping onto Sirius's chest is very heroic. Kind of gets me a little bit, that moment where Cruikshank just leaps onto his chest to protect him
mm-hmm.
from Harry.
Yeah.
Nice little cat moment. Cats aren't all bad.
He's a Neasel.
Cats are bad, but Neasels
are great.
Fair enough.
Something that makes me so annoyed about this book is it gives such a bad reputation to pet rats. Pet rats are amazing, and the whole time I was reading this, I just miss my rats so much because they're in Canada right now because my friend is watching them, and this makes it seems like rats are just awful things. They're great. They're great pets.
Well, the regular pet rats seem fine, but when you're a disguised killer mm-hmm. rat, that's probably
yeah. If your pet rat was a murderous human.
I don't know. I think I'd still love my rats. I love my rats more than I love my own life.
Yikes.
We'll interrogate
that. If only Peter Pettigrew had been given to Abby, he could have been
I do have a cat also, though, so, like, probably wouldn't go down that well, but, you know.
So here's a big question. I think there's a pretty simple answer to it, but I'm curious. Do you guys believe that Harry would have really killed Sirius here?
No.
Nope.
Yeah. Nah, he just wanted to beat the shit out of him at the moment.
Yeah, he didn't even want to kill Pettigrew, so I doubt he would actually kill Sirius, because...
I think he would have tried. I don't think he knows how.
Yeah, I wonder
That's the other question, right?
How difficult killing curse is to actually pull off, and if you, like, get a little wrong, do you just, like, paralyze him or whatever, or is it all or nothing?
He'd probably use whatever he has. Like, I don't know if he knows the
killing curse. Expelliarmus him to death.
Yeah, right. And just grab him out. This is excruciating. Like, it's just taking forever, and then he'd probably come to his senses, maybe.
I just really don't think he would do it, because, and, like, 50 pages later, he doesn't want to kill Pettigrew, and that's, like, Harry's whole thing, isn't it, that he only will use Expelliarmus, he won't, like, AK anybody, and I don't know.
It's because they didn't teach him better shit.
Yeah, they teach all the third year. They should teach them all how to kill people. His defense against the dark arts real
that
training.
That will be the fourth year.
This is the flame-throwing charm.
Isn't that like the Karo's defense against the dark arts?
Yeah,
they teach them how to do that.
Yeah.
They're like, it's basically just dark arts.
So. Yeah, basically.
So what you're saying is the Karo's should have started teaching sooner.
The only thing that'll stop a bad wizard is another bad wizard.
Sorry, can I just read the passage where Harry decides?
Yes.
Okay, because I think it's, like, important. Harry raised the wand. Now was the moment to do it. Now was the moment to avenge his mother and father. He was going to kill Black. He had to kill Black. This was his chance. The seconds lengthened, and still Harry stood frozen there, wand poised, Black staring up at him, Crookshanks on his chest. Ron's ragged breathing came from the bed. Hermione was quite silent. And then came a new sound, and then Harry stood there feeling suddenly empty. He hadn't done it. His nerve had failed him. Black was going to be handed over to him, back to the Dementors. I think, like, a lot of what this is about is, like, what you view as actual, you know, revenge, right? Like, Harry, I think, comes to realize that this is not, like, it's almost like a young person's assumption of what, you know, the worst thing would be. Because even, like, Sirius is way more scared of the Dementors than he is being killed, you know, even just from his own perspective. And I think, like, the fact that Harry is going to that and can't do it is, like, speaks to the fact that he knows, like, this is A, wrong, and not, I think, something that he's really capable of, but also not justice in a way, as we see later.
Oh, that's really interesting. Are you saying that he thinks that Sirius deserves worse than death, that kind of thing? Like, he deserves a worse fate than
no,
that?
No, I'm simply... saying he's 13, and he thinks that, like, the worst thing that you can do is kill someone. You know, even with all he knows about the Dementor's Kiss and all that, like, he's still thinking, he's kind of still in, like, the headspace that Voldemort never grew out of, you know, which Voldemort is, like, death is the worst possible thing, and that's it, and that's the end of the discussion. Whereas, you know, it becomes a lot more nuanced with Dumbledore's perspective, and I think even later when Sirius does die, that element.
Right. So he thinks he's failed here by not killing him. He has not.
Yeah, but he can't do it. Like, clearly he has some kind of spell in mind. You know, it's not AK, but it's something, and he can't bring himself to do it, and he views that as a failure when it's obviously, for a lot of reasons, not a failure. It's a mark of who Harry is, actually, because I think other people would have done that, would have attempted to kill Sirius. I don't know if they would have succeeded, but...
While reading that scene, I wondered, like, Harry thinks that, like, he has a voice telling him, it's now, let's do it now. And I know it's quite early, and I'm not even sure, the whole Harry as a part of Voldemort in him was already clear, but do we think that it could have had an impact on his rage, or is it just him?
I was wondering that too, actually, like, where that voice comes from.
That's something I do think about as well, like, what is the line, like, where, like, does all of Harry's anger come from the fact that he is a part of Voldemort inside him, or is that just, like, a catalyst for it? And I personally think it's the latter. I think that he has a lot of legitimate reasons to have that rage in him beyond the fact that he's got a piece of Voldemort inside him, and that's just kind of a catalyst that makes it more extreme at times.
I tend to agree, because the things he hears are usually Voldemort is intending him to hear them, in one way or another, or they're things that Voldemort is saying, and he's not intending Harry to hear this, but he's actually engaged in that conversation. So I think that this is it's more of like a metaphorical, like, you know, idea. I mean, but I guess you could like get really like crazy and meta and be like, well, maybe Harry could have been the servant of Lord Voldemort. Like, if he had listened to that voice, like, you know, it would have sent him down a dark path or something.
I do want to ask at that point, when we get to that chapter, who is the servant of Lord Voldemort? That's kind of an interesting question. All right. Just want to say one last thing that I really felt strongly reading this again, is that for me, I think this is a moment in the story, in the totality of Harry Potter, where it does go up a level in terms of the storytelling. Just the contrast between this final moment in this book versus the first two books is so dramatic for me. I've mentioned on previous casts, when we've reread these books, the first two, the dramatic moments in the books feel much less to me than they did when I read them as a kid. The tension resolves very quickly, but in this one, the tension is so palpable and so drawn out, it felt completely different to me. And just the way that there's so many twists and turns and revelations that come one after the other, it feels like such an upgrade in the storytelling. I just want to note that.
Agreed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we can talk about that later, but it's also like this book doesn't really have a happy ending, whereas the first two, like, were more full success, you know?
Yeah. Taking our steps into the more and morally ambiguous, murky ground of Harry Potter.
For sure.
You know, this is, I think, the first time we see two sides of, like, the same person in terms of, like, Lupin, you know? Like, it's the first time we see Lupin the teacher become Lupin the person. And like the differences and the connections between them, which of itself is just a different emotional level to engage with things.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing too, in terms of reading it as a kid or reading it as an adult. That's the kind of revelation that you have as a kid growing up, is that like teachers are people too, and that your parents are people too, and all these things that you have to reckon with. And those same kind of lessons are expressed in these books, which is, you know, it's important stuff to learn. It's good that those themes are included. All right. Small Paul, you will be summarizing chapter 18 for us, I believe.
Yes. So picking up where we left off, we start with Ron being completely unable to come to terms with the fact that his lovely pet rat is actually a traitor named Peter Pettigrew. Obviously that's impossible because magic, I guess. Sirius Black is still fucking pissed and just really wants to kill Peter, probably as much as Harry had wanted to kill him a few moments earlier. However, Lupin, ever the calm head in this situation, stops him and suggests that perhaps they should explain everything first, which leads them to have a bit of a flashback. Back to the days of earlier...
You and your damn sound effects, man.
Back into the days of when they were in school. When he first arrived at Hogwarts as a young werewolf, Lupin didn't have very many ways to essentially let out his inner wolf, and so Dumbledore devised a way for him to leave Hogwarts secretly and safely through the Whomping Willow and stay in the Shrieking Shack during the full moon. Thus explaining the name, the shack was never haunted. It was just inhabited by a teenage werewolf. Lupin's friends, James Potter, Sirius Black, and Peter Pettigrew, were constantly noticing his monthly absence and figured out his true identity. Since they're such good friends, they decided, hey, let's be animals with him. So they worked on becoming animagi so that they could become animals themselves, and as well as keep him company without placing themselves in danger. So apparently, werewolves don't attack any other animals, just humans, apparently. The four friends would roam around everywhere and learned every part of Hogwarts and Hogsmeade, and they ultimately used this information to create the Marauder's Map. At this point, Hermione points out that there have only been 7 registered animagi over the century, and Lupin admits that they did this illegally. He then expresses his guilt for never having told Dumbledore that Black was an animagus and could have entered the castle in another form, but explained that he felt deeply grateful to Dumbledore for giving him an education and a job, that he didn't want to let him down. Lupin then explains that Snape, who now makes the revolutionary potion Wolfsbane that allows Lupin to keep his mind, thus remaining harmless during his transformation, as a student was always curious about the monthly disappearance. One evening, Black even played a prank by encouraging Snape to follow Lupin down to the Whomping Willow, and James Potter ran after him and rescued him before he encountered the fully grown werewolf. The trick is one of the reasons for Snape's grudge against Lupin, Black, James Potter, and his son Harry. As Lupin finishes explaining this, however, we have the one and only reveal. Ah, damn it, I messed up. Anyway, Snape pulls back the invisibility cloak, revealing he was there the entire time.
Dang it.
Okay,
there we go.
Thanks, Paul.
I have poorer writing, but higher production value.
That's one way of looking at it.
So, yeah.
Yes, Snape was here the whole time. Well, at some point he showed up.
Yep, at some point.
I did go back in my reading when I got there. I was like, wait, I'm sure there was a sentence somewhere that said that he entered, but we didn't know. And yes, they're like a very, very clear, oh, the door opened by itself. And then no one cares.
They're like, I don't know what that was. Let's carry on.
Yeah.
What the heck?
I do like that there are, like, I think, distinct parallels between what Snape accuses Harry of and Lupin's accusations to himself in terms of, like, these rules that you resent were put in place so that you could have opportunity and chance and be safe and people around you could be safe. And you are ignoring them because you feel like it and it would be more fun not to. And, like, I found a very strong kind of echo of Lupin's words in the way Harry is perceived and sort of is.
I never thought of that parallel before, but yeah, that totally works. It's interesting though that, you know, Lupin at least at this point clearly feels guilt about that. Do you think Harry would ever feel guilt about his actions at any point in his life?
I think only if his actions caused someone to get injured or hurt in some way, then he'd feel bad about it, but
I feel like they have.
Yeah, so I think otherwise, though, because he's so young, it's not something you really, you know, you don't really think about your actions have consequences, I guess, unless you're kind of, your consequences are in looking you in the face. Like in the fifth book with Sirius, you know, he's told, don't try to contact Voldemort, you know, and then he does, and it's all a trap, you know.
Good point. That's the key moment where he does.
Yeah.
Guilt.
But I think even earlier in the book, like when Lupin is like, you know, it would be a poor way to repay your parents by dying, you know, I think that's coming from, I didn't like realize it at the time, but I think that's coming from this same sense of kind of self-resentment of Lupin's. And I think Harry does, like, he doesn't go anywhere near the one-eyed witch. He like is surprised even that Hermione does it. It's, yeah, I think he takes that very seriously.
Yeah, he really actually doesn't seek out trouble to the same degree that he did before that moment, until that moment in Book 5 with the Sirius and the Ministry and all that. Like his incidents in this book and in Book 4 kind of are incidental. They're not really his fault that he'd sought those situations for the most part. So yeah, that's interesting. He definitely took that to heart, those words from Lupin. Thoughts on the backstory? Any thoughts on the backstory of the Marauders? The origin story of those guys?
I mean, when I first read this, I'm always a sucker for, like, lore and backstory. And so when I first read this, I was really interested in the Marauders, and it was kind of nice because I kind of saw it at the time. First hearing about the Marauders, I was immediately like, oh, they were like the Gryffindor trio of back in the day, and Peter Pettigrew kind of ended up betraying them, but we don't know why. And I just I really enjoyed looking back on it, but then later what we learn, what they kind of were towards, like, Snape and others later on, it kind of shows that while we're immediately wanting to make them apparently look just like our heroes right now, oftentimes people are far more different than we give them credit for.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm no Snape apologist or anything. I think that his actions towards Harry and Neville are completely crazy, but like not crazy, but like just unjustified. But the Marauders, I don't understand why people are so fascinated with them, because to me they just kind of seem like a bunch of douchebags who run around school. Like, there's such, Sirius is such an asshole to Peter. Like, I know he's mad at him, but they treat him like shit when they're friends with him too. They're always like, oh, Peter's, you know, this like crybaby who can't do anything, and he needs his, you know, older friend, his cooler friends to prop him up. And I mean, personally, I know people in high school and, you know, grade school that were, they're cool and stuff or whatever, but they're just such douchebags. And I know that they kind of are stuck in their 20s, because like that's when, you know, all this bad stuff happened to them and things. But personally, I don't know. I'm not that interested in the backstories of the Marauders, just because the more you learn about them, like you said, is just the more they're kind of just assholes. I don't know. Like, they have redeeming qualities, obviously, and she fleshes them out more, but I don't really understand why people are so fascinated by them.
Lupin.
Yeah. James, at least, is kind of the, like, the Rhaegar of Harry Potter. You know? you want to meet him to actually hear more about his story, because, like, everyone is perfect, everyone loved him. And, of course, you learn that he wasn't so perfect, that, and you can...
He's reverse Rhaegar.
Yeah. No, but you see what I mean, right? It's these kind of characters that are really admired by a lot of current characters. And even though you learn of some things that are not quite okay, I mean, you still kind of want to make apologies for them. They seem similar to me. Like, I wasn't it. I just, as a kid, and still now, kind of fascinated by the Marauders and this whole group of people.
Yeah, I think they are fascinating because we do... Like, I don't think they were as fascinating before Book 5, and we had that scene where James is objectively bullying Snape. Because I think, like, you know, the truth is somewhere in between, you know? Like, Sirius does not seem to be at all repentant for the fact that, like, Snape might actually have died. And he not only might have died, he would have caused Lupin to be his killer. And obviously Lupin wouldn't have been to blame for that, because he's not in his right mind. But I think it's pretty safe to say that would have had a very scarring effect on Lupin. You know, but, you know, James is the one who stepped in, and obviously I think it's, Snape is not wrong in saying that there's more than just altruism going on there. Yeah, he would have been in a shit ton of trouble, but, like, you know, there are kind of layers to what they do. But, I mean, Sirius is really tough, actually, because he is, this is a hard word to use in this context, and I'm using it with, like, a bunch of asterisks, but, like, he's borderline abusive to Peter, and, like, it seems like this is old behavior, judging by what we've seen in, you know, in that one flashback. Like, it's justified here, but it's, you know, you contrast the way Lupin treats him and the way Sirius treats him, and Sirius is just, like, insulting... He's insulting, whereas Lupin is mostly accusing. And it's a really interesting contrast that, like, I don't know, I think Sirius is a really complicated character, because it's true, he is stuck in kind of, like, suspended animation, and he's still 21, and he, you know, doesn't know how to act like a normal person anymore. But at the same time, like, the way he acts is really not good.
And the Blacks kind of were not the best.
Right. Family. I think you see some of that coming out. Like, and he does it for, like, the right reasons, yeah? But, like, it's not necessarily right just because it's done for the sake of good people.
Right. One thing I always found interesting was that with Sirius, we're supposed to believe that he comes from this kind of dark family and, you know, is very abusive. They're these evil wizards. And he breaks free of that, like, through his association with James. And, like, he, you know, they teach him how to, like, be a cool dude and be a good friend and all that. But, yeah, they were kind of, like, the school bros, it seemed, for a bit. So, I don't know. We don't really get enough of that. It almost seems like he has an excuse. Like, Lupin sort of has an excuse with the werewolf thing. Peter sort of has an excuse. But the only one that doesn't really seem to have an excuse is James.
See, I think Sirius is the one that doesn't have an excuse, because we're supposed to like Sirius and think he's a nice guy because, wow, you weren't as much of an asshole as the rest of your family. And, I mean, when I was a kid, I think I liked him more because I was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, he gives Harry this hope for a better future. You know, he can be Harry's surrogate dad. Like, he's the cool uncle. But I don't know. Something about him is just like, wow, you're a good person because you weren't a giant racist. Like, you know, I don't know. And you were a good friend to progress. To two out of your three friends,
two-thirds of your friend group.
I'm constantly amused by the idea of just thinking of Sirius as the kind of person who peaked in high school and then it was just all downhill from there. Like, is he even good at anything in particular? Or is he just known as the one black
who was
incredibly racist?
He has mad stacks.
Like, this is a mean thing I'm about to say, and I feel really bad because I'm, like, shitting all over Sirius, right? When we're supposed to, like, like him the most. But the thing is, like, I do kind of wonder, in an alternate universe where Sirius Black was born, Sirius Weasley, like, would he have become a dark wizard? Because he's a naturally rebellious person. A lot of what comes out in book five is like he didn't want to be like his family. He sought out James Potter. Like, they became friends because he was like, fuck my family, I'm not doing this. But, you know, and part of that obviously is because he has a better moral compass than they do, for sure. And he does know right from wrong, and he does want to not, you know, be evil. But I wonder, you know, I kind of get stuck on the idea that, like, Sirius's personality can go in so many different ways, and it just happened to kind of manifest in this particular way, you know? Like, if his family hadn't been like, you shall be evil and you must be a Slytherin, blah, 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 you know, would he have gone a different way?
I think there's something to that. It's kind of hard to imagine that counterfactual, right? Because, you know, there's so many factors that you don't really know, like, to what degree he would be that rebellious if he was, like, in a loving home or something like that. But it's so hard to parse that. But I think for me, these ideas aren't mutually exclusive. You know, like you say, Abby, I think Sirius and all the Marauders do come across, especially as kids, as douchebags to an extent. And Sirius is definitely the most fraught character, even through his adulthood. But I still find him incredibly fascinating as a character. I still find him to be by far the most interesting of those characters. And in so many ways, he's an interesting, this idea of suspended animation that he is stuck in is so cool. And all these, you know, ideas that he's trying to enact, but he fails to. I like that a lot. And he likes Snape. I mean, both of them, there's so many layers of complexity there in terms of whether they're a good or a bad guy, you know, that kind of stuff. And I don't know, I can enjoy the character without thinking that he's a good dude. And I think there's reasons why Harry is drawn to him. You know, there's a charisma to him and a heroism to him that I understand why he's drawn to that.
The thing with Sirius is, like, he needs a cause, right? Like, he needs something he's kind of an obsessive personality, I think. And his ultimate downfall is when he has no cause and he thinks he's, you know, he's
a rebel without a cause.
Well, yeah, and he's stuck in his childhood. We don't have to get into book five Sirius. There's a lot to say there, but, like, I think it's a big tell that here he's like, the reason I was able to escape was because I was obsessed with keeping Harry safe, which is obviously very noble and awesome, you know. But I think a lot of the time in Harry Potter, actually, you have people doing good things, and their reasons are mostly good. But then there's always something, you know, Mrs. Weasley is a lot like this. like, you know, she's incredibly nasty to Sirius, and she's actually nasty to Hermione, you know, and a lot of it comes from her being extremely protective of Harry and wanting to keep people safe, but she does some not great things because of that, and so it's just a theme to keep your eye on as we proceed.
Indeed. We'll obviously revisit Sirius plenty in book five, so we'll keep that in mind, and just generally this idea of characters that they're complicated. Some pretty complicated characters in this book, including one that we're going to talk about a little bit here in chapter 19, which I believe is Michal.
It is, but before I say that, I do just want to say, once again, you can kind of see Dumbledore's strings being, like, attached to, like, Lupin and Harry. Like, Dumbledore, I think, is really good at finding the people who he can influence. And again, like, it's for good reasons, and mostly the outcomes are good, but if Lupin hadn't been that obsessed with Dumbledore's good opinion, like, the things that might have been different are significant.
There is a complicated character, right?
Yes!
All right. Yeah, let's do chapter 19.
Okay. The Servant of Lord Voldemort. Peter Pettigrew squirms in the Weasley boy's hands, the hour of his judgment approaching. A brief flash of hope comes and goes with the arrival of Severus Snape. Peter had let himself wonder if, after all these years, Snape might be an ally in the Dark Lord, but the Bloody Children had intervened on Remus's behalf, knocking Snape unconscious. The Weasley boy is, at least, still reluctant to give him over to the other two marauders. After all, how among the millions of rats in the world, how could Sirius have possibly identified Peter? Pettigrew considers this to be an excellent argument, but Sirius points out his missing front paw and explains Peter's exact movements on that fateful morning, crying for James and Lily, blasting apart the street, removing his finger, and disappearing down the sewer as a rat. That finger, once his salvation, is now his damnation. Sirius's information goes further. Clearly, 12 years in Azkaban have dimmed Black's beauty, but not his intelligence. He knows that Peter faked his death once again, letting the silly children believe that he had been devoured by that damned cat. Of course, the vile creature had been in league with Black. Peter thinks once again that he should have seen this coming. Another agonizingly brief moment of hope as Harry Potter grows angry once again on Peter's behalf. Sirius, bless him, can't keep murder out of his mind or his voice. But then Harry says those words, those cursed words. He was their secret keeper, and Pettigrew knows that the floodgates of truth have been smashed open. Peter had been the secret keeper. It had been Sirius's idea, and the outcome still torments Black. He blames himself for Lily and James's unfortunate end. Peter silently agrees. Why had Padfoot always had to have to be so clever, so twisty, putting Peter's feet in the fire? Oh, no one will suspect, he had said, but Peter knew that suspicion was hardly the problem. And then his bond with the Weasley boy fails. Peter finds himself in Lupin's hands, squeaking in terror, and the next moment he is back in his true body. His bones are heavy, his tongue thick, the meager lights of the shack overwhelming. Well, hello, Peter, says Remus. Peter makes a decision then. The only way forward is to continue to bluff. He begs Remus for help against the murderer Sirius Black. I knew he'd come after me, he cries. I knew he'd be after me. He'd be back for me. I'd been waiting for this for 12 years. Yes, of course Sirius could escape from Azkaban. He has those dark powers taught him by the Dark Lord himself. Peter's tongue is moving faster than his mind, but he can see the black light of truth hardening in Sirius's eyes. Voldemort, teach me tricks, he says, and Peter flinches back. The cold white face, the livid red eyes, the laughter that meant both safety and pain. But Sirius calls out another horror in Voldemort's supporters, those in Azkaban and those lurking without in this cold world, Malfoy and McNair and all the rest. If Voldemort's supporters were after me, it was because I put one of their best men in Azkaban, the spy Sirius Black, he protests. But this unleashes more venom from Sirius. I, a spy for Voldemort, he says, when did I ever sneak around people who were stronger and more powerful than myself? But you, Peter, I'll never understand why I didn't see you were the spy from the start. You always liked friends who'd look after you, didn't you? It used to be us, me and Remus and James. Lily and James only made you secret keeper because I suggested it. I thought it was the perfect plan, a bluff. Voldemort would be sure to come after me, would never dream they'd use a weak, talentless thing like you. It must have been the finest moment of your miserable life, telling Voldemort you could hand him the Potters. It had, and it hadn't. Peter doesn't want to think about it. The Granger girl speaks. She asks why Peter has never hurt Harry before now. Oh, she doesn't ask Peter. She asks Sirius. And Peter tries to seize the moment, but Sirius storms in. I'll tell you why, says Black, because you never did anything for anyone unless you could see what was in it for you. Voldemort's been in hiding for 15 years. They say he's half dead. You weren't about to commit murder right under Albus Dumbledore's nose for a wreck of a wizard who'd lost all of his power, had you? Were you? You'd want to be quite sure he was the biggest bully in the playground before you went back to him, wouldn't you? Why else did you find a wizard family to take you in, keeping an ear out for news, weren't you, Peter? Just in case your old protector regained strength and it was safe to rejoin him. This exact calculus had played itself through Peter's mind so many times over the past 12 years that he's left without words. The terrified whine in his mind grows higher as Granger asks Sirius how he escaped from Azkaban, and Sirius tells some tale about understanding his own innocence, keeping his powers, and transforming into that fucking dog. Believe me, Sirius says to Harry, believe me, Harry, I never betrayed James and Lily. I would have died before I betrayed them. Harry nods, and Peter loses all feeling in his two large limbs. He begs Sirius for his life, begs Remus, who finally understands that the werewolf, of course, the werewolf, was mistaken for the rat. Ron rejects Peter, nasty, ungrateful boy. The girl pulls away, and Harry, 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 Peter whispers, Harry, James wouldn't have wanted me killed. James would have understood, Harry. He would have shown me mercy. Sirius and Remus take over, throwing Peter painfully to the floor. He can conjure no more denials, can only babble about his fear, the terror of Voldemort, and death and the damage closing in on every side. You don't understand, he cries. He would have killed me, Sirius. Then you should have died, Sirius yells. Died rather than betray your friends, as we would have done for you. You should have realized, says Remus, if Voldemort didn't kill you, we would. Goodbye, Peter. Peter takes one last terrified breath. And then the boy who looks like James, oh, so much like James, Peter can truly see it now with his human eyes, steps between him and his brothers turned executioners. You can't kill him, he says, proposing instead that Peter be taken to Azkaban. A happier word has never graced his ears. He is saved, no matter that Potter treats him like filth, no matter the Dementors. The Dark Lord will honor those in Azkaban. Peter knows, he hopes. He barely notices as he is bound and chained to Remus and the Weasley boy, barely sees the cat strutting before him. There is only his heart, beating so much more slowly now, but on and on. And the view from the corner of his eye of Remus's wand pointed at his chest. So that was that.
Excellent. That was so good. Thank you. I love that we got POVs for the two main villains in this book, Peter Pettigrew and Aunt Laurie.
Yeah, right.
Got them both. That was interesting to think about it that way. I honestly, as a reader of these books, I don't think about Peter Pettigrew very much and like his perspective and his opinions on things and how he got to the point where he's at, but clearly other people do, and I'm curious to see what the thoughts are on him as a character.
I mean, my major thought about Peter in general is that, like, people mistake him for a Slytherin when he's actually, like, a perfect Gryffindor, because I don't know what a coward would find more attractive than the presence of strong people. And I think that, like, it makes sense that would be something of an aspiration for Pettigrew at some point in his life. So I think, like, that's to me how I understand Pettigrew, that he's like a Gryffindor gone bad and not like a misplaced Slytherin for plot reasons. So I think, like, he's so motivated, like, all of his, like, a lot of what he does takes a lot of balls, right? But it's interesting that that's all motivated by fear, because he never says, like, oh, you treated me so badly, or blah, 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 blah. He's, you know, his focus is always his own survival.
As Ned Stark says, if you're, when you're afraid is the only time you can be brave. And he's afraid all the time. So in a way, he is brave all the time. In his own way. It's interesting. Yeah, I've never really given him much thought in that way, but I think there is a lot there, and I think it does a disservice to the story not to think about him in a more complex the way than as a coward and a sneak and a villain that's just doing whatever he can to survive. I think there's a lot of motives that you can unpack from that are cool, and like we just talked about, how culpable some of his relationships were to going down that road.
Like, we never know, right? Like, we don't know what drove him to being, you know, to Voldemort. Like, what was the point that like, he switched over? Was it just like, well, this side's losing, I'm going to go to that side? Or was it something that somebody said? Or, you know, I feel like I don't want to make it sound like I'm like, oh, poor Peter Pettigrew. Like, obviously he's awful. But I do think that, like, it's worth considering, because he is kind of one of the pivotal actors in both the past and the present. Like, it's really interesting to consider how he became that way and why.
I think it's partially because he doesn't have a lot of loyalties, I guess, is what I would think. Sirius is kind of correct in his assessment of Pettigrew when he's like, oh, you'll go to the biggest bully on the schoolyard, you know, because that will offer you the most protection. And so he doesn't have that much loyalty one way or another. It's just more towards who is the winning side. Like, I don't buy his story for a second that he was worried Voldemort would come after him, you know, whatever. But you see it in the seventh book when he's killed because he wavers, because he starts thinking back on his loyalties. You know, he doesn't kill Harry because he feels guilt, or not guilt, but like he feels a little bit of loyalty, I guess, to Harry in a sense. And so I think he went to Voldemort just because that was the side that offered the best outcome, I guess.
And like we were talking about, wondering about Sirius's mental fortitude after spending so much time isolated and in Azkaban and stuff, I wonder how Pettigrew's mind is doing spending 12 years as a rat hanging out with the Weasleys for so long. That can't be too good for your mental acuity and how you're thinking about the world and life. It's got to be weird.
Yeah, I'll get to this in my chapter, the last chapter, with some of the stuff Dumbledore says. But I think it, at the very least, in the ways that characters interact with Peter Pettigrew, especially Harry, there's some pretty, I think, intentional parallels between him and Gollum in Lord of the Rings. A piece of that, of course, is how they're kind of warped by their isolation. All right, I just want to do a quick Snape check-in here. Obviously, Snape shows up and he's angry at Sirius. And there's kind of a one big line here where he's talking to Harry and he says, "You'd have been well served if he had killed you." Which is kind of that the stuff we talked about as far as Snape kind of seeing the arrogance in Harry that reflects his father and his willingness to put himself into danger that he really shouldn't be. But I'm kind of curious, like, what do you think his main motivation for coming here was? To go get Sirius, or was it to protect Harry?
I think it was to protect Harry, because shouldn't Snape have known that Peter was actually the secret keeper and Sirius didn't actually betray the Potters, because Snape was the one that Snape was, like, super involved in that whole plot, wasn't he, to kill the Potter? Like, he wasn't involved, but he knew about it and everything, because he obviously, like, begs for Lily's life. So, like, shouldn't he know that Peter is the secret keeper?
Yeah, but specifically, like, he begs for Lily's life, and I think for that reason, maybe Voldemort didn't quite trust him enough, or maybe he does trust him, but it's not even the point. Like, he doesn't have to tell everything about every plot to every one of his followers. And it suffices to say that he got the information. He doesn't necessarily have to say who gave it to him.
Yeah, I actually don't know. I don't know if he knew that Pettigrew was involved. It does, like you say, Marie, it's a kind of Voldemort thing to not, to kind of have different, you know, different things in the fire and not tell everyone everything and just not have any servant that has too much information or power. But yeah, I don't know. And that really actually does change the way that you think about how he enters this scene.
But like Snape, like he's blinded by a lot of things, mainly his hatred for Sirius and James. But he's still not stupid. And I think if he had known that Pettigrew was the secret keeper, he wouldn't. How can you know that and still think that Sirius betrayed them? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and that makes you wonder too, right? Like, how much of his hatred of Sirius at this point is just the schoolboy stuff, or like being involved in getting Lily killed? Like,
yeah,
is that a thing?
Yeah, and actually, like, it raises another question for me. Did Dumbledore know who was the secret keeper in the end?
I don't think so. I don't think until this stuff happens. No, I don't.
No, I think he even says, like, you know, he believes it along with everybody else, and because he can't give evidence for Sirius because he doesn't have any.
Well, doesn't he also? I want to admit I didn't actually read the first 300 pages of this book in preparation for this reread. But doesn't he tell Harry to keep a lookout for Sirius and like be careful because he thinks that Sirius is a murderer? Or I don't know, maybe he's fucking with Harry because he seems to do that a lot. But you know, he doesn't always tell Harry the whole truth. But I don't know. I feel like he definitely thought that Sirius was the secret keeper.
Yeah, I agree. One question, you know, there's this part where Harry tells Lupin and Sirius not to kill him. And he says, like, basically says, like, he thinks his father wouldn't want his friends to kill his other friend. He's like, do you think that Lupin and Sirius have not killed people before? Like, they've never killed anyone?
I definitely think they've killed people before. I feel like the Order probably had to do that. It's a war.
I just noted that line, like, not wanting to have them have, like, a death on their conscience. I guess a little different. Killing someone that is not a direct, like, enemy and stuff like that.
Well, also, is unarmed.
Someone try to kill them.
Pettigrew is unarmed. Whereas I'm gonna assume that, they would have been in conflict situations. This is really an execution.
True. Very true. I agree. All right. Any other thoughts on Chapter 19? I guess, like, my last thing is, like, when I first read this, and I still get this, like, feeling, like, when I read the chapter title, The Servant of Lord Voldemort, it's pretty clear it's about Pettigrew, but I always, like, think Snape, mostly because he's the last thing that happens in the last chapter, so it's just, like, a natural kind of progression, but I don't know, I just have that thought, like, maybe there's a double meaning to that.
Yeah, there could be. I mean, I get hung up on Snape not bringing the Wolfsbane potion, because, if you think Harry's in danger, well, you know.
Bit of an oversight.
He brought it to the office and then just left it.
Yeah, I think it's deliberate oversight, to be honest with you. I think he saw his opportunity to make good and sure that
Lupin was discovered. Yeah,
and if he bound him, he probably would have been like, well, he'll transform and then everyone will see.
We've talked about this a bit, and we'll talk about it more later, I'm sure, but it's not really clear at this point that, like, protecting Harry is Snape's main priority at this point.
Yeah,
like,
I'm not sure it is.
It's not clear at all that's his number one motive at all times.
I don't know, yeah.
Like, what would Snape have done, though? Like, because he binded Lupin, but he would still have transformed once they got outside, and from what I gather, it's like a werewolf is quite powerful. Like a human cannot really easily defeat him, even a wizard, I think. So, did he think about that at all?
He's Snape, so I tend to think he just thought he had it under control, which is the exact same thing he thought about Lily and Voldemort, right? Like, I can do this. I can make this work. It's fine.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable interpretation of it, for sure. All right, Abby, I believe you're taking us through Chapter 20, The Dementor's Kiss, where shit really goes bonkers.
I was going to say, shit goes to hell.
Yeah, when I first saw this, I was like, oh, it's only 5 pages. Maybe I'll just read the whole chapter. But there's a lot of shit that happens in this chapter. So yeah, okay. Chapter 20, The Dementor's Kiss. I apologize for the summary, because it's really just a summary. So, Harry, Ron, Hermione, and co. all leave the Shrieking Shack, heading back towards Hogwarts using the hidden passage. Sirius offers to take Harry in once his name is cleared, which makes Harry really excited, because then he can leave the horrible Dursleys. Upon leaving the tunnel, Lupin, who's now exposed to the full moon, begins to transform into a werewolf. During the chaos of this transformation, Peter transforms into a rat again, after snatching Lupin's wand, and he escapes. Sirius, having turned into a dog, fights Lupin and gets injured. Lupin runs away, and the Dementors approach. Harry is unable to cast his Patronus and is about to be kissed by a Dementor when a great blinding light scares the Dementors away. Harry faints. The end.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very straightforward chapter in terms of, like, there's not, like, a lot of, like, character stuff and all this to mine in this. I think the interesting thing in particular is, at the beginning, you know, that kind of excitement that Harry does immediately have of escaping the Dursleys and getting to go live with his godfather. It is kind of it feels sudden to a degree, but we talked about a bit why it kind of makes sense that he's down for that.
It's also, like, to me, this chapter is so crazy because, so I'm reading the old new copy with the old new covers. So it's like the top of page 380, you know, they're still in the tunnel and Crookshanks must have pressed the knot because they're all going up. And then at the bottom of 381, Sirius gone, Pettigrew transformed, like everything is like totally gone to shit. Like the situation changes completely in less than two pages. It's just like really funny.
It's so frustrating. Like,
yeah. I know my first recap that I wrote was like, this is the last chapter. And this is the end, and nothing else happens, and it's all fine.
I love how frustrating it is, though. Like, you're so close to making all this work, and it's all going to be good, and it just gets ripped away. I love that kind of thing. And it all makes sense. I mean, we talked about why it's kind of weird that Snape didn't bring the potion, but otherwise, like, I get why they kind of forgot about Lupin with all this stuff going on. Like, it's just another twist that was set up through the whole book. Like, he was a werewolf the whole time, and it came to fruition here in the right way for everything to go wrong.
And they kind of double the frustration by right now they let Pettigrew slip through their fingers and get away, and then Harry and Hermione have to do it again when they're there for the second time and let him escape again. So it's just super frustrating that time.
Yeah, I have a question, because Lupin, there's a question of what you guys think. Lupin doesn't transform until they actually go outside. So if they had stayed in the shack the whole time, would he just have kind of, you know, been a normal person? Like, does he need to be exposed? Because it seems like immediately once he sees the moonlight, he switches, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it was already, it would just turn to nighttime. I don't know what the whole clock.
Yeah, situation. I have to think it's like they reached peak full moon, and that's what happened. Because he does go to the Shrieking Shack normally and transforms
It would be crazy otherwise. You just, okay, well, I'll just stay inside and everything will be well. It's like, I don't think werewolf would be such an issue if you could just stay inside.
I don't even go outside anyway.
Or you just walk around with an umbrella.
Yeah.
So, well, but
world's not touching me.
The thing is, though, the line is a cloud shifted. There was suddenly dim shadows on the ground. The party was bathed in moonlight.
It's for the narrative effect, like that. Oh my god, the moon!
Yeah, no, I get that, but it seems like it was already midnight, and there was just a cloud in front of the moon. And so, the cloud had stayed in front of the moon, like obviously, I understand that it's established that he just always transforms, but it's very convenient. I don't know.
So it's not even midnight, which is what I thought. I was like, okay, so they come out the exact time that, like, the clock strikes midnight and it's the night of the full moon or whatever. But when they get locked in the hospital wing, Dumbledore's like, oh, it's 5 minutes to midnight. And that is, like, at least an hour after this happens. So that's not it either. But yeah, I just kind of headcanon that it's like, that is whatever makes it the full moon happened at that moment. And like, it's just for dramatic effect that like the moonlight came out and whatever.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Okay. Something else that, sorry, we were talking about, sorry, I kind of sidetracked us, I feel like, but we were talking about Harry being excited about Sirius. And something I noticed was Harry basically continues to refer, I don't know, maybe this is a British thing. I don't know. You just call everyone by your last names, but he refers to Sirius as Black, just like, you know, by his last name, until something happens. Sirius gets injured. Then he calls him Sirius a couple times in his narration, and then he goes back to calling him Black. I don't know if that's significant at all, but it's just something that stuck out to me.
Hmm.
Yeah, that strikes me as an inconsistency. I think it, in terms of how it would make most sense, is that once he thinks of him as someone familiar, he would start calling him Sirius and from there. Who knows? All right. Yeah. Any other thoughts on this one?
I was also wondering, so Sirius runs off as a dog, and then Harry comes on him, and he's a human being attacked by the Dementors. But in Azkaban, the Dementors weren't bothering with the dog. So how did he get transformed back into a human to have the Dementors mess with him?
Well, he was injured by Remus, I thought, and so maybe, like, his magic wore off.
If you get injured, then you turn back to a human, maybe?
Yeah, he might not have had the strength, I don't know, to continue being a dog. I don't know how animagi work, but maybe he didn't have the strength to continue being a dog because he was not prepared to have to turn into a dog, and then he had a fight. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe he was vulnerable because he was feeling a lot of negative emotions at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, actually,
the sheer number of Dementors bearing down on him and focusing on him maybe overpowered his animagusness.
Yeah, I think that's a good point also, that he, like, you know, in Azkaban it wasn't like, we're looking at you 100% of the time, Sirius Black. And it would make sense that, like, it would be hard to conjure, like, a happy thought. I mean, not to mention he doesn't have a wand, but, like, he literally, just like Harry, went from, like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna be an innocent man, I'm gonna take my rightful place as Harry's, like, stand-in father, you know, all this stuff, and then it's like, this one mistake shatters everything, and Pettigrew's gone, and it's all bad, so it kind of, I can see it.
Yeah, it sucks.
And the other unfortunate thing that you want to wonder about is, there should be some kind of magic spell that if a rat starts running off, you'd be like, I see a rat, and it comes right back to you. That a rat can't just run away and then you can never find it again. That seems
right.
That seems a inconvenient thing to have happen. You should have a magic spell to be able to track a rat, is all I'm saying.
Well, there should be a spell where if you bind someone and then they shrink suddenly, the bindings would shrink as well or something like that. I don't know. Or they could have petrified him instead, something. I don't know.
Really, we just except that the book required him to get away, so he got away.
But also, I mean, like, so Lupin had a wand, and the kids don't know the Axio charm yet, so Sirius doesn't have a wand. Although I guess he does have Sirius's wand, but then he drops it because he runs off.
I don't know, maybe it's like in D&D, you know, where you have to like concentrate, and so then whoever cast the spell, their concentration was broken because, you know, Lupin turned into a werewolf, and then, you know, I don't know.
I don't have any trouble buying any of this. I think just the chaos of the situation, it works for me.
But it was more frustrating in the after one when Harry and Hermione are watching again, then they could like go intercept the rat.
Well, you can't mess with the timeline, you know. If they had done that, Voldemort would have won.
Anything involving time travel, I just automatically glaze over and I'm like, whatever.
You can't do time travel, as we're about to find out.
There were 14 million possible outcomes and only one.
Any other thoughts on this one before we move on?
Or Lupin. Can you imagine him just, like, waking up the next morning and just, like...
Yeah. All right. Adam, want to hit us with a Chapter 21 summary? Some time travel.
Pretty simple chapter.
Yeah, very straightforward. Chapter 21, Hermione's Secret, a.k.a. A Time for Time Travel. Harry awakens in the hospital ward with Snape boasting about his heroic acts and Cornelius Fudge saying that he should get Order of Merlin, and like Snape's really all about that. He's pretty cool. Ron is passed out, but Harry and Hermione leap out of bed and begin explaining what they heard and saw. And Snape generously waves this away, saying they must be confounded instead of condemning them as supporting Sirius and Lupin. Let's see, once the others have left, Dumbledore tells Harry and Hermione that he has heard Black's story and he actually believes it, which is good for them. But that it's not gonna help, because even though Dumbledore is the most powerful wizard, no one really... gives him credit for anything he says in the magical world, apparently. So he passes along some wisdom to Hermione, a little wink nudge, and says maybe they can save two lives tonight. And Harry's very confused, but then she explains about the time turner that she's had to get to her studies all year, which are kind of ridiculous, doing two classes at once, and we'll get to that. But Harry and Hermione proceed to go on their first ever date, setting up what should have been the eventual
Shut
pairing.
Up. I will not tolerate this nonsense.
So they go back in time several hours and spend a lot of time avoiding themselves and, you know, seeing the events that, as they played out from the bushes, mostly they save Buckbeak just in time. They hear Hagrid's howling, which actually realized that he was crying in joy because Buckbeak got away and not because he died. Then they go back into Hagrid's cabin to hide after running from Werewolf Lupin. And then Harry realizes that he just wants to go peek and see what happened because he thought he saw his dad, and that's crazy. But then he goes out and realizes that there's no one there, and there's no one there, and there's still no one there. And he realizes, oh, it must be me. So he casts the Patronus charm, and this time, instead of a oozy jet of liquid coming out of his wand, it's a fully formed Patronus in the form of a stag, and he saves the day, and it's cool, and they fly up to Professor Flitwick's office and take Sirius away.
the end. No problems with this ever again. Time travel never comes up in the story again.
I gotta say, I love Madame Pomfrey's boulder of chocolate. Yes. That's probably my favorite part of this chapter.
Salty Madame Pomfrey is like the greatest.
Yeah, so good.
I'm also a big fan of like Harry having no idea what's going on, and Hermione just being like, "This is how time travel works. Get with it. Like, come on."
She's got it figured out. She gets it. She's read about Eloise Mintumble. She knows that story. Sorry. Anyone, if you want to learn some cool time travel Harry Potter history, read about Eloise Mintumble. Does Dumbledore know what's happening in the past?
Yes.
Like, this past Dumbledore. Yeah, it seems like he really does, right? Like, and why and how? How does he know what's going on?
I mean,
Dumbledore has a copy of the Marauder's Map.
It seems to me like somewhat Dumbledore logical that he would always be a little bit like, well, I guess it's possible that my future self could be, you know, or that people from the future could be involved in what's going on now. And like, he could have been like, well, I definitely think that they would have gone down to Hagrid's, and I definitely hear them leaving. And you know, like, I feel like it's not so crazy that he would have figured it out. Also, he would probably have known if at that point in time Buckbeak had gone missing.
Okay, no, it's time travel paradox. Yeah. I didn't want to get into that. Ah, like, how does he know?
Yeah.
That, I mean, he's like, if all goes well, well, you know, all goes well because you saw that Buckbeak didn't die. I mean, ugh.
Well, but he's saying that for their benefit, less not his. But he also could just straight up spell it out, you would think, because what they do is not overly complicated here. Just go down there, hide.
So, save Buckbeak. Yeah. And then fly to the tower and save Sirius. Done.
He says it like someone else is around listening to their secret plans and he has to say it in code, but it's just that.
I mean, plausible deniability is kind of Dumbledore's MO, isn't it?
He's always getting other people to do his shit for him.
He is.
Yeah. He's kind of the worst. I mean, because even here, when he's like, well, I believe Sirius, but he'll still die tonight. And you're like, well, dude, you could stop that. Like, you're strong enough to just stop that. And like, you can force your will on everyone else if you really wanted to. Like, instead, you're like, oh, yeah, that time turner thing that I ordered for no reason for Hermione this year. Perhaps that's useful and keeps me out of it.
But I am just a feeble old man who knows nothing of the ways of war.
I don't know. I kind of buy Dumbledore not being able to act in another way in this particular situation because, like, the whole wizarding world thinks Sirius is guilty. Like, this is a known fact. You know, it's a lot harder to, like, act directly against a fact than it is against a assumption or something like that, you know?
Yeah, but he's not acting saying, like, we're freeing Sirius and I'm having him teach here tomorrow. Like, he's just being like, we're not going to have him executed tonight until we get to the bottom of this, which is kind of reasonable. Like, you could still keep him under lock and key.
He doesn't.
But what's the end game there, right? Like, just delaying it. Like, how does he play that out in a way that gets Sirius out of there? I think he saw that this was, like, the best way to get him out of there.
How does he also have a jurisdiction to be like, no, we are not going to sentence this person? Like, I know he's a very powerful wizard and he's probably a pretty influential dude, but he doesn't work for the ministry, you know, he's not in justice, the judiciary.
But also, we've seen that in the magical world, like in the magical courts, like proof and evidence is not what we would assume. You know, they're like, hey, you cast this charm and it was Dobby that did it, right? Like, they don't really know what the fuck's going on. So it's just a lot of people that get together and yell at each other and be like, oh, I guess it makes sense, guilty.
Yeah, but like, but the truth for those people so and the Congress. One that would win in the court, that's the point, right? Is that if he had gone to court and tried to prove Sirius was innocent, he would have lost. Like, they would have decided arbitrarily that he was guilty because that's the truth for them. And he even says pretty clearly in this chapter, I have no power to make other men see the truth. Which causes him a lot of problems, that fact, at all points in his life, that
constantly,
idea.
Constantly, yeah.
And will be a key point of tension for him in book five. He can't make people see
that. For two books, there's no efforts to even clear Sirius. He's just like, we'll just have him work in hiding, because nothing can be done about it, apparently. Which makes perfect sense, but lies get spread like wildfire in the magical world, so who knows?
in another bit of ministry incompetence, the McGonagall had to register that time turner with the ministry, and then none of the ministry remembers that Hermione has it when she's the one involved here at the end to look in on that and say, that's curious. I wonder what she was doing with that thing.
Yeah.
They don't keep good records.
Bureaucracy. I'm sure it was someone on Percy's level who...
Yeah, I'm sure.
You would think the time turners had some sort of tracking spell, right? So you'd know when it's being used and what for.
You would think a lot of things about time turners.
But yeah, they wouldn't be allowed to use
to be existed. Yeah.
No, but I think like part of this is Harry again like leveling up in maturity a little bit about like the idea that the systems that are in place are not, you know, because the whole book has sort of been about like all these legal systems are in place to protect Harry, right? And they're all useless, you know. And then not only are they useless, they're actively acting against justice, and they're not interested in learning otherwise. So I think that like I'm trying to find the wording, because I'm gonna quote the book here. Harry stared up into the grave face and felt as though the ground beneath him was falling sharply away. He'd grown used to the idea that Dumbledore could solve anything. He'd expected Dumbledore to pull some amazing solution out of the air, but no, their last hope was gone. And then obviously Dumbledore is like, hey, Hermione. But like that to me is such a powerful, because I remember feeling that same way. Like, what do you mean Dumbledore doesn't have the answer? Like, what are you talking about? We're trying to stop something that the Minister of Magic wants to do, you know? I think that's leading into the way book four ends, which is only a year off. I think that's an important step in Harry's maturity. I think the next book, it's more like, it's more about the press and about not necessarily trusting the press. And in this book, it's about those kind of like systems that you intrinsically trust, whether it's Dumbledore or whether it's the ministry.
Yeah, I think by the time we get through book four and five, this sort of thing makes sense, where it's just like, you know, okay, yeah, no one's listening, no one's on board, like, you can't trust anyone, you just go outside the ministry. But at this point, like, reading this, at least for the first time, it didn't feel like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Adam, you're just as innocent as Harry was. You believed in the systems, and they let you down.
I think Fudge is incompetent, so, you know.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think like everyone knows he's incompetent, and that's why he's in charge, because no one wants anyone to actually be running things.
They're all just serving their own agendas. They don't want a powerful...
Yeah, he's the peacetime minister.
Although it makes you wonder why they wanted Dumbledore to be the minister at one point.
It's probably different groups of people.
Yeah, it's true. There's different opinions. I do like, you know, it's a nice little point in Sirius's favor at the end where he kind of is considerate of Ron, just wants to make sure he's okay.
Yeah.
Before he hits out. It's a nice little Sirius. It's not all bad.
He was the one that broke his leg and messed him up.
That's probably why. But he would have been shitty if he was like, I don't care about that kid. Fuck him.
He's a ginger.
That would have been worse. I guess like the big dramatic moment in this chapter is, of course, Harry conjuring the Patronus, saving himself. Kind of a, you know, sort of metaphorical, like he's stepping into a, like, it's the kind of same thing, in a way, you know, he expected to be saved by something or someone, in this case his father.
Why did he think it was his dad?
I guess because he looks like him, so, he saw someone that looked like him, his dad, so.
I think
and
it's
isn't
fair,
he hearing
like...
his mom's voice when the Dementors come?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's already, like, he's already kind of losing consciousness, and like, the night has been quite crazy in Revelations. Like, Sirius Black did not kill my parents.
Maybe my parents are still alive.
Yeah, I mean,
hiding this whole time.
How could he think? Like, there's no way he could think that it's himself. Like,
yeah,
he's
not
there yet. So, it's not that. I mean, I don't really see any other explanation. Like, who could that be?
Yeah. That's the first reason his mind kind of latched onto that made sense to him.
Oh.
And yeah, I think it is significant, right? Because he does have to save himself. It is that same thing with the ministry and with power figures like Dumbledore, is that he realizes at to some extent at this point that he has to be responsible for himself and there's no one that's going to come save him. He still believes in his father. He hasn't like lost faith in his father at this point, but it's kind of a crack there that I don't know that like he is the source of his own salvation, not someone else.
Well, yeah, but it is tied into James with the stag. That's what Dumbledore says in the last chapter. Yeah,
in a way, it kind of increases his faith, even though he's the one who conjured the stag. But it makes an increased connection between himself and his father. You know, he sees his, like him following in his footsteps in that way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, chapter 22, Owl Post again. Harry and Hermione rush back to the hospital wing to unite the timelines before Dumbledore locks the door. Snape finds out what happened and comes flying back in a rage while Dumbledore smirks behind him. Finding no answers, Snape retreats and Fudge goes to report to the Ministry. Ron awakes and learns what he missed. The next day, the group wanders the grounds to process everything that has happened. Sirius was saved, but all is not well. His name has not been cleared, so Harry will have to return to the Dursleys for another painful summer. Lupin's werewolfiness has been discovered, and he has been forced to resign from his post as Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. No one could have seen that coming. Most importantly, Pettigrew has escaped to make whatever mischief he may. Dumbledore speaks with Harry and tells him that he should be very proud of himself for what he did the night before. Harry laments that it didn't make any difference. Pettigrew still escaped, but Dumbledore reassures him, saying, "It made all the difference in the world, Harry. You helped uncover the truth. You saved an innocent man from a terrible fate." This reminds Harry of Trelawney's prediction, which he reports to Dumbledore. Dumbledore is unfazed by this information, saying that Pettigrew owes his life to Harry, and that when one wizard saves another wizard's life, it creates a certain bond between them, and I am much mistaken if Voldemort wants his servant in the debt of Harry Potter. This is magic at its most deepest, its most impenetrable, Harry. But trust me, the time may come when you will be very glad you saved Pettigrew's life. Harry is unconvinced, and his spirits remain low. For all that, he is able to enjoy another House Cup victory feast with his friends. On the Hogwarts Express, Harry, Ron, and Hermione enjoy the time together they have left, and Ron tells Harry that he must come with the Weasleys to the Quidditch World Cup this summer. To everyone's surprise, an owl arrives with a letter for Harry from Sirius. He reports that he and Buckbeak are safely in hiding, and reveals that it was he who bought the Firebolt for Harry, and that he was the dog who Harry encountered that night on Magnolia Crescent. Finally, he shares that he has signed the Hogsmeade permission form for Harry, which I'm sure no one will have a problem with, and he gives the little owl to Ron as a gift too. Harry arrives at King's Cross and makes sure to tell Uncle Vernon that he is a convicted murderer looking out for him. The end of Book 3, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Very nice.
Yeah. So I think I mentioned this before. So much like Tolkien with Gollum, it seems like J.K. Rowling is trying to say something about the power of mercy here through Dumbledore. He's kind of making that point. Thoughts on this idea? You know, it's incredibly frustrating in the moment that Pettigrew escapes, but technically saving Pettigrew does contribute to Voldemort's eventual downfall when he like kills himself when they're escaping the Malfoy Manor. That helps.
Well, it saves Harry's life, which allows him and Ron to save Hermione's life. It's a pretty significant. Yeah. It is interesting that, you know, Sirius's accusations are so like, you would never go back to Voldemort unless he was the biggest bully in the playground. And he ends up going back to Voldemort because of circumstances when he's like a total wreck and literally forced to nurse him back to health and nurse him back to life, basically. So it's an interesting kind of contrast. And it actually is an interesting choice that Pettigrew chose to do that, right? Like, Voldemort's situation was the same, you know? It could have been whatever, like, it would not necessarily have changed. He would have still been, like, a wisp in Albania if Peter hadn't...
Like, Voldemort's situation is a lot different, but Peter's is also a lot different. He goes from being in hiding and no one knowing he's alive to people know he's alive, and all the people in the magical community obviously aren't going to be on his side. And if he doesn't go back to Voldemort, he has all of Voldemort's remaining supporters in hiding that aren't going to be on his side. Mm-hmm. So his option would be to try to disappear to another country or something, but that doesn't seem like his cup of tea.
Yeah, but it's interesting in terms of, like, the circumstance of the prophecy, you know, that, like, it wasn't necessarily that he was Voldemort's most devoted servant. He was maybe Voldemort's most desperate servant, you know?
It's true. And it's notable, too, that he does all that all that, and he's still treated like a rat, pretty much. Gets no reward for any of that, really.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, he's still treated like shit among the Death Eaters. Like, Voldemort straight up is abusive to him. So it's very, like, I don't know. I find Pettigrew really interesting.
Yeah, it's hard to parse the actual moment when he does kill himself with the metal arm. Like, is that his will, or is that, like, magic taking over his body? Like, what is the driving force behind that? And that kind of complicates this question, right? Of, like, what is the power of mercy here? Is it actually a magical force that takes over, or is it actually, like, Pettigrew, like, feeling bad or, like, having remorse? Like, what is the line there?
I feel like Harry, I'm just trying to remember from reading it, like, Harry feels him stop. Like, he pauses for a second. And that is what triggers the spell that kills him. So it's like, yeah, it's almost like a magnet of mercy, right? Like, Harry's act of mercy, which causes and connects to Pettigrew's act of mercy, which, of course, Voldemort can't have, so that leads to his death.
Yeah, I think that's the interpretation I would go with. And it is, that it actually makes it a little more interesting than, like, in Lord of the Rings, spoiler for Lord of the Rings, Frodo's act of mercy and not killing Gollum, it just kind of coincidentally leads to, and this is magic of its own, I'm sure, you know, weird world magic, but it coincidentally leads to the ring being destroyed, just, you know, Gollum falling off and dying. Like, that's the end game for that. But yeah, both kind of trying to, I guess, make a statement about mercy as a kind of a primordial force in a way that's gonna kind of be rewarded in some capacity. All right.
Snape crazy.
Yeah, goes off the handle here. Thoughts on that? Clearly, I don't think he's in Dumbledore's confidence yet, which is interesting. You know, he's not party to the decisions that Dumbledore is making here. He's very much seemingly on his own path, and I wonder if there was, like, a conversation after this between them.
Yeah, I think it was mentioned on the last reread. I mean, like, how his character evolves in later books, and that might just be part of, you know, the way the narrative went, and wanting to kind of keep us guessing as to what his deal was. But here, he definitely seems to be more out of the loop, less concerned for Harry, more kind of concerned with his own revenge, his own kind of pettiness.
Extremely petty, his act to reveal that Lupin was a werewolf at breakfast. Mm-hmm. just because he didn't get his Order of Merlin, or his, you know, annoyance about
I wanted an Order of Merlin. Where?
Well, to be, I mean, I'm not defending Snape, I'm really not. But he is, Dumbledore is, like, actively fucking with him. Like, there you have it, Sirius, said Dumbledore calmly. Unless you are suggesting that Harry and Hermione are able to be in two places at once, I'm afraid I don't see any point in troubling them further. Which is like, you know, that's exactly what happened.
Oh.
But I think Dumbledore has a very complicated relationship with Snape, and I think, like, there's many ways in which he is not concerned with seeing Snape suffer and sweat and not get what he wants.
I also think, like, in this early books, even if this one is starting to get a bit darker, we still have, like, the comic relief of Dumbledore being amused by the situation, and Snape is losing it, and Dumbledore just laughs inside, and it might not make much sense for their relationship overall, but it's a way to lighten the situation for the reader as well.
Yeah, I think it's really hard in general to try to figure out, like, what was figured out and what wasn't at this point. And I don't think it necessarily is important. I think we just kind of take what we have on the text, and we don't have to get into, like, authorship and where things were planned. But I definitely just feel like Dumbledore is kind of a more...
Yeah, I mean, she'll tweet about trolley. It one day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll figure out what's going on. That'll make it canon. I just want to note again, I talked about this a lot in the last reread, but I do want to note again how much Hermione has grown throughout this book. You know, you kind of see the culmination of that in this chapter, where she says that she's not going to take all these classes next year. She learned her lesson. She knows her limits. I think that's an important it's an important, you know, step forward for her character and just generally becoming a more confident, capable person and kind of understanding who she is and what matters to her.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't she say something like, oh, and nobody needs that kind of turn, like a time turner? Or am I inventing that in my mind because I want her to have said that? But I do like the end, you know, at the end of Dumbledore and Harry's conversation, which is kind of like the most low-key of their post-year conversations. Right. Like, you know, and he talks about how, you know, Harry found his father inside himself, and that's where Prongs comes from and all that. And Dumbledore left the office, leaving Harry to his very confused thoughts, which I just really like, because it's not like, like, the rest of the chapter actually gets quite a bit more like the first two books with, you know, yay, we won the House Cup, we're eating, and everything is all red and awesome, and, you know, and, oh, I'm going to go tell, you know, the Dursleys that my godfather's a murderer, you know. But I think, you know, that, so that's kind of an interesting line of, like, it's kind of, it kind of bridges the gap of Harry being, like, in this more mature space, but then also being, like, 13, and it's summer, and, you know, so he's not, like, struck by the incredible profundity of what Dumbledore says, basically, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it is, like, the least, like, profound, I mean, this profound shit here, like I was talking about with Mercy and all that stuff, like, the least profoundly impactful one on Harry, this particular conversation. He doesn't really seem to take much lessons from it, at least in this moment. And it's interesting that Dumbledore himself, it doesn't, like, the, you know, we learn later that Dumbledore kind of remarks at certain moments in Harry's development when he was going to kind of reveal the full story to him. And he like, one of them is in the second book, and he decides, no, I'm not going to do it. He's too young. And it happens again later. But that's not, like, a thing he considers at this point. It's interesting that it's not really part of his thought process, especially, you know, I don't know how much credence he actually lends to it at this point, but knowing that apparently Voldemort's coming back, that's kind of where he learns that here, so.
He really should have taken this opportunity. He had a perfect opening. Harry was like, hey, Professor Trelawney made a prophecy. I was like, huh, okay, that's not connected to anything else you need to know about. Like,
yeah, it's extremely straight. Like, this is the I have the hardest time understanding where he's at in this book.
Yeah, and it, maybe it's explained in the book. I'm not sure, but does Harry know why Voldemort was particularly interested in his parents? Like, why they had to have the Fidelitas charm thing to protect themselves?
I don't think he knows, no.
Because it's pretty specific. Like, not everyone in the good guy's side does that. So it's obviously because of the prophecy, but...
Yeah, I think, I mean... At least when I don't think he gets that until either 5 or 7, I don't remember. But I think it was more, because this was what I thought when I was a kid, because I totally, my brain, like, jumped over prophecy in general, was that his parents were just, like, the most actively opposing Voldemort. Or, you know, like, they were doing something very oppositional, and so he was like, oh, if I take them out, it'll, you know, maybe Harry thought, Voldemort's thinking was, oh, if I take them out, then... that will hurt the order a lot, you know, something like that.
I agree. I think that's the extent of his idea of why they were targeted. It's just that they were threats to his power in some vague way, so he was going to go deal with them. All right, let's see. Do you guys want to revisit the ridiculousness of the Hogsmeade permission slip being signed by Sirius? Like, that's good enough for Dumbledore, I guess, so you can
go to Hogsmeade. I thought it was McGonagall that approved the slips.
Right. He says here Dumbledore, but it's kind of weird that no one else checks that Sirius Black is the one who signed it.
He'll just have to tell McGonagall, ask Dumbledore about it.
There's another small inconsistency about Percy and Fred and George getting their newt and owl results back, because they're not supposed to do that until the beginning or till the middle of the summer.
Maybe they changed the protocol.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. It just graded really fast this year.
Why? Like, if this permission slip is found by anyone else, like, they're gonna be like, okay, so Sirius and Harry are in contact. So you just, like, if
Harry can just send letters and Hedwig will just magically find Sirius Black. Will you just have to want to send a letter to Sirius Black and like track the owl?
Yeah. It's like some weird like consent that has to happen. Like,
and how does the owl know? Like it can. I mean, it's valid for the whole series. Like, how do they know where to go? Doesn't make sense.
I don't know. I feel like like with the permission slip, I think we talked about like on the first part of this book. Like if it wasn't for like the threat of Sirius Black, like Dumbledore or Professor McGonagall would have been like, whatever, I'll sign it, it's fine, you know, let him have his fun. So yeah. Maybe they don't necessarily need to, like, who's gonna, like, okay, I see the permission slip, they burn it, and that's the end of it, you know, it's not kept on file or something, I don't know. But tracking, I don't really think they're trying hard to track Sirius Black down after this for some reason. He just shouldn't go anywhere where he's going to get caught.
I mean, doesn't he?
They're all terribly busy with the World Cup. They simply couldn't concentrate on the mass murderer at large.
That's right. Well, or the Dementors there.
Yeah. Does he automatically go to Grimmauld Place? Because then wouldn't it be untrackable if he's at Grimmauld Place?
No, I think he's hiding in a cave for
okay,
a while.
Okay, never mind.
I think that's actually what he's doing.
I'm trying to remember because I haven't read these obviously since they came out, but in book four and maybe into book five more, like, do they blame some of the stuff going on Sirius? Like when the Dementors return, like, are they, yes. They're looking for him among that group, right?
Yeah. They think he was the one who did the, well, this is more book five, but like, he's the one who did the mass breakout. Like he was the one who did that and that kind of stuff.
Right.
All right. Any final thoughts on Prisoner of Azkaban, the third book of Harry Potter? Before we wrap it up,
I feel like we should just take a moment to enjoy the relative lack of depressingness.
Oh, no, the next book is my favorite.
Yeah, I know, but the end of the next four books are just so sad.
I like to be able to cry, okay?
No, I'm with you, Abby. I love the sadness to come. Those are my favorite parts of the series, and it'll be exciting to get there soon enough.
Sweet we'll muggle discuss... tears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I also realized I haven't read these books in a really long time. I've read the first book so many times because, like, I'm always like, oh, I'm going to reread the series. And then I read the first book and don't go to the next one. So I'm like, I don't remember anything beyond the first book.
It's like when I watched, like, a pilot of a TV show, like, 12 times trying to get into it. Yeah. But I don't. All right, cool. Well, I think we'll call it there for Prisoner of Azkaban. Glad that we got here. We're three books down.
Woo!
Yeah, only four very long books to go.
Yeah.
And time turners never appear again.
Never.
Well, they show up in Cursed Child.
What? Not
Abby, you really missed the subtext on that, no offense.
Well, no. Don't the time turners actually show up because they break them all in yes. The fifth book? So,
they do show up.
Off screen, they are destroyed as a plot conveyance.
Well, technically, they're on screen. All right. That's that. Thank you all so much for joining me once again for the Harry Potter reread. Always so much fun. Always happy to talk about Harry Potter, and we are getting into some really good stuff to come, so I'm excited about that as well. Thank you everyone for listening to this, and you can look forward to that. More Harry Potter to come. Are there any other podcasts that people want to shout out that are on the way?
There's a reread, Game of Thrones reread next week is being recorded. That was delayed.
Thank goodness that we can talk about A Song of Ice and Fire and not that stupid TV show.
Speaking of which, there will be more show-related content.
Yeah, we're going to... I think we're going to... You want to talk about that a little bit, Adam, what the plans are for that?
Bina... And, oh, yeah. So, I mean, like, the part at the end, obviously, where Tywin comes back from the dead. Anyway.
Can say whatever you want, and I just stop listening until you tell me that I can come back. But one or the other.
No spoilers. But Bina and I are doing some content, like focusing on how the show ended and the divergence from the books, and possibly, you know, what we might actually see in the books with what we've gotten from the show. I think she's doing mostly like character focused arcs, like how characters fared in the show and whatnot. And so we'll have that coming out
for a while, weeks to come, maybe.
Exciting. And there are a couple TV shows I think people are pretty excited about that aren't Game of Thrones.
Good Omens.
Yeah. Chernobyl. There's some big ones that I think we're going to be talking about soon.
Handmaid's Tale's coming back.
Handmaid's Tale.
That's so much exciting. Fun.
Yeah. So lighthearted.
Real party. Yep. If you want an actual party, watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this season, because they just had an episode where two people went to space and got high. So.
Ah, that's fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. High in space.
Gotta catch up.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you, everyone, again. And if you want to check out any of our stuff, you can do so at VOKpodcast.com. You can check us out also on YouTube, and you can check us out on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, and all the places. And if you want to come chat with us about any of this stuff, you can do so at the Podcast of Ice and Fire forum, which is very easy to find. Thank you all again, and we'll be back again very soon.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.